Rediscover God's Word, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is Real Bible Study with teacher Tom Bradford. Welcome to Torah Class.
Just as Bible scholars tend to divide the book of Zechariah into two books, 1 Zechariah, that is chapters 1 through 8, and 2 Zechariah, that's chapters 9 through 14. So they further divide 2 Zechariah into two sections, chapters 9 through 11 and 12 through 14. Now, different scholars have differing perspectives on the second section. Some thinking of it in terms of Israel's day, meaning moment or time of atonement. Others as it being about Israel's conflicts and subsequent victory and conversion to being believers in Yeshua and ultimately their sanctification. And yet others see it as dealing with the various predicaments that Israel has historically faced, both internal and external, especially as concerns Jerusalem. That is, Israel has always dealt with hostilities and differences within their own faith sphere, and also from external pressures, from foreign adversaries that on a couple of occasions involved invasion and exile. But chapter 12 lays out how God is going to resolve this troubling historical pattern once and for all. Zechariah chapter 12 speaks to a future age, what modern folks loosely call the end times, when a great confederacy of enemy nations makes war against Israel. And it deals with a number of events that are prior to the return of Messiah Yeshua to rule and reign. Although some of the later events might be happening as part of the immediate results of his return. Now, tragically, Israel will suffer greatly and be decimated, and yet in the end, miraculously come out the victor, with a remnant surviving. Her enemies will be decisively dealt with, and what remains of Israel, meaning the people, will enjoy a permanent peace and sufficiency in all things. The prophet makes it clear that all that is predicted will happen because the Creator has ordained it, and therefore nothing can change it. Now, I want to emphasize that final point. Nothing can change what has been predicted. There are substantial Christian denominations, however, who believe humanity and our planet can avoid these outcomes if only we'll do the right things now. In fact, some go so far as to believe that Messiah only returns once these conflicts and evils have been resolved by Christian leaders. That is, he waits on a kind of worldwide, human-devised utopia to be established so that he can then come back to a peaceful and godly world population to rule over. Now, a goodly part of the reason they believe this is because they shun the Old Testament and the prophets as no longer having relevance. In their doctrinal beliefs, the birth of Yeshua inaugurated a new era with a different set of laws to follow, a different God, the Gentile church replacing Israel, and so all the predictions of the Old Testament prophets have no meaning. I assure you, they are far, far off the mark. Now, as I have mentioned a few times, as valuable is the book of Revelation for us, the minor prophets and three or four of the major prophets are where we find the bulk of the information about the end times and then thereafter. The fact that what is going to happen is unchangeable and irreversible means that the reason we need to know about what these prophets say is so we can properly interpret history as it unfolds around us, so that we can know what to prepare for. See, it's very much parallel to Joseph in Egypt. When Joseph arrived and was later made second in command over all of Egypt, Egypt was thriving. It had such an abundance of food, they were selling it to the foreigners that needed it. There was nothing going on there that would say trouble's coming. Yet Joseph convinced Pharaoh that Joseph's God had told him there would be 7 more years of this agricultural abundance, but that this would be immediately followed by 7 years of very low food production. Pharaoh believed Joseph. He believed Joseph's God was so powerful that nothing they could do could avert the 7 years of famine. So Egypt's leadership went on a long-term nationwide campaign to prepare for it by storing away vast food supplies. We're in that same position today. God has told us in advance what's going to happen. So we need to be wise and react properly to that knowledge. That doesn't mean that we won't face hard times, no matter how prepared we might be. But it does give us an opportunity to do what we need to do to better survive it. Still, whether we do or not depends on if we take God's word seriously. And it also depends on our faith leaders pointing us to these prophecies, rather than the large majority of church leaders we have now who dismiss them as no longer relevant, and thus a waste of time to study, except perhaps as a historical curiosity. So, open your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah chapter 12. A prophecy, the word of Adonai concerning Israel. Here is the message from Adonai, who stretched out the heavens, laid the foundation of the earth, formed the spirit inside human beings. I will make Yerushalayim a cup that will stagger the surrounding peoples. Even Judah will be caught up in the siege against Jerusalem. When that day comes, I will make Yerushalayim a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who try to lift it up will hurt themselves. All the earth's nations will be amassed against her. And when that day comes, says Adonai, I will strike all the horses with panic and their riders with madness. I will keep watch over Judah, but I will strike blind all the horses of the peoples. The leaders of Judah will say to themselves, those living in Jerusalem are my strength, through Adonai Zevaot, their God. And when that day comes, I will make the leaders of Judah like a blazing fire pan in a pile of wood, like a fiery torch among sheaves of grain. They will devour all the surrounding peoples on the right and on the left. Yerushalayim will be inhabited in her own place. Yerushalayim, Adonai will save the tents of Judah first, so that the glory of the house of David and the glory of those living in Yerushalayim will not appear greater than that of Judah. But when that day comes, Adonai will defend those living in Yerushalayim, and on that day, even some who stumble will be like David. And the house of David will be like God, like the angel of Adonai before them. And when that day comes, I will seek to destroy all nations attacking Jerusalem. I'll pour out on the house of David and on those living in Jerusalem a spirit of grace and prayer. and they will look to me, whom they pierced. They will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son. They will be in bitterness on his behalf, like the bitterness for a firstborn son. And when that day comes, there will be great mourning in Jerusalem, mourning like that for Hadad Rimon in the Megiddo Valley. Then the land will mourn, each family by itself, the family of the house of David by itself, and their wives by themselves, the family of the house of Natan by itself, and their wives by themselves, the family of the house of Levi by itself, their wives by themselves, and the family of Shimei by itself, and their wives by themselves, all the remaining families, each by itself, and their wives by themselves. The first thing we see is that the words to come in this chapter are preferenced by calling them an oracle. In other words, this is something God is pronouncing. It's not the prophet deducing it or using divining powers to look into the future or even having inspired thoughts put into his mind. This is direct communication from God, which is something unique to true prophets of God. Just who is this God that is giving Zechariah the oracle? Despite virtually all English Bibles obscuring it, we find that in the original Hebrew it says Yehovah. By saying this, the fullest weight of what Zechariah brings via this prophecy is brought to bear, and no one can doubt which God is the one pronouncing it. Now, don't get tunnel vision and think this is referring only to chapter 12. This opening oracle, who it's from, who it applies to, has to do with everything that follows now, all the way through the end of Zechariah chapter 14. Now, the next issue is who exactly this prophecy concerns. Thus, immediately after establishing that this is coming from Yehovah, we read, this concerns Israel. Sounds straightforward enough, but the reality is that the term Israel appears nowhere else in chapters 12 through 14 than right here. And up to now, the concern in 2 Zechariah has been for Judah and Jerusalem. So is Israel a term the returned Judeans adopted and used for who they are? Or is this speaking about the northern kingdom that came to be called Ephraim? Or is this speaking about all of Israel, both houses, all 12 tribes? The verses do not make that entirely clear. I think this can be reduced to two possibilities. The first being that Israel became an alternative name for the returning exiles from Babylon that they began to use for themselves. It remains a Jewish tradition to this day that the Jews, historically meaning descendants of Judah and Benjamin, consider themselves as representing the remainder of all 12 tribes. Further meaning that the 10 lost tribes as a separate entity is a myth. The second more likely solution is that this is referring collectively to all 12 tribes, both houses of Israel, Judah and Ephraim. Now, an interesting statistical fact is that of over the 1,000 times the term Israel appears in the Bible, only 17 times is it used to refer to the southern kingdom, Judah. Even more when we read, like here, the words that the Hebrew most literally says is burden of Yehovah, we can contrast that strange phrase with one like it from an earlier in Zechariah chapter 9, when we read burden of Hadrach. Hadrach is representative of the pagan world's religions, while Israel is representative of God's religion. So I lean towards this passage referring to the second of the two more likely choices. That is, in this case, the use of the term Israel is meaning all of Israel, not just Judah. Now, the remainder of the first verse makes it clear that Yehovah, Israel's God, and the one pronouncing this oracle, is also the creator of all things. He stretched out the expanse of the heavens, the universe, laid out the foundation of the earth, created human life. This is one of the more clear passages in the Old Testament that speaks of Yehovah as the only God in existence, and not just the one and only God that Israel's allowed to have. See, the monotheism that we all think about today, meaning only one God in existence, is nowhere present in the Old Testament. This was an era when the Hebrews still believed there were many gods performing different functions and assigned to a variety of nations. It's just that their God, Yehovah, allowed Israel to worship only him. So verse 2 opens with that special Hebrew word that amounts to, pay attention, something amazing is about to happen. That word is hine, and it means behold, or indeed. It is announcing something surprising, or unlikely, even history-changing. And what is it that's going to be history-changing? It is that the relatively small, rather crudely built and out of the way place, that city that has been captured and burned and rebuilt, only to be captured again, called Jerusalem, is going to become a cup of trembling to the people surrounding it. The Hebrew word ra'al is used to express what English often translates as trembling or reeling. It means to stagger around as a drunk person. Now, when a cup of something is used, it means that whatever is in the cup is a quantity of something that is set apart for a person or a group to experience. It is more usually a negative thing, but there are a couple of rare instances where it is used positively. Then we are told that these peoples, plural, round about Jerusalem are involved in some way, and that they are going to be badly affected. Now, the Hebrew translated as peoples is amim, and very often this is a term used for God's people. Here it seems to be broad and all-inclusive. Very often this is a term that these peoples, who are probably foreigners this time, aren't far away. They're somewhat near to Jerusalem. And one might expect to find the word goyim here instead of amim. Goyim is a term that means Gentiles, or just as often, nations, with the understanding that since Judah or Israel is the only Hebrew nation, all other nations are Gentile nations. So considering the context, there can be little choice but to see these Gentile people groups and nations that are relatively nearby to Jerusalem. That said, because Jeremiah and Zechariah are so closely aligned in what they prophesy, it can be helpful to go to Jeremiah and see what this prophet has to say about what is surely the same event. And as is typical of Jeremiah, he goes into more detail than Zechariah. Since this is an end times time frame, then it seems to me we need to pay close attention, because these events may be much closer to us in time, literally just around the corner, and the likelihood is greater than ever we may be alive to experience it. Jeremiah 25, starting at verse 15, says this, "For here is what Yehovah, the God of Israel, says to me, take this cup of the wine of fury from my hand. Make all the nations where I'm sending you drink it. They will drink, stagger to and fro, behave like crazy people because of the sword that I will send among them. Then I took the cup from Adonai's hand and made all the nations drink where Yehovah had sent me. Jerusalem and the cities of Judah, along with their kings and leaders, to make them a ruin and an object of horror, ridicule, cursing, as it is today. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, with his servants and leaders, all his people, both native and foreign, all the kings of the land of Uz, all the kings in the land of the Philistines, that's the Philistines, Ashkelon, Gaza, Ekron, those remaining in Ashdod, Edom, Moab, the people of Ammon, all the kings of Zor or Zidon of the coastlands across the sea, Dedan, Tamar, Buz, all those who cut the corners of their beards, all the kings of Arabia and of the mixed peoples living in the desert, all the kings of Zimri, of Elam, of the Medes, all the kings of the north, far and near, one after another, indeed all the kingdoms of the world that there are on the surface of the earth, and the king of Sheshach will drink last of all. And you are to say to them, here is what Adonai Zevaot, the God of Israel, says, drink until you're so drunk that you throw up and you fall down. And you never get up again because of the sword I am sending among you. And if they refuse to take the cup from your hand and drink it, then say to them, here's what Yehovah Zevaot said, you must drink. For look, I am bringing disaster on the city that bears my own name. Do you expect to go unpunished? Yes, I will summon a sword for all the inhabitants of the earth, says Yehovah. Now as for you, Jeremiah, prophesy all these words against them and say to them, Yehovah is roaring from on high, raising his voice from his holy dwelling, roaring with might against his own habitation, shouting out loud like those who tread grapes against everyone living on earth. The sound resounds to the ends of the earth. For Yehovah is indicting the nations, about to pass judgment on all humankind. The wicked he has handed over to the sword, says Yehovah. Clearly, Jeremiah's prophecy lists a number of nations in the Middle East region that are nearby Jerusalem on a relative basis, if one takes into account the overall size of the entire globe. However, Jeremiah is essentially saying that all the nations, both near and far to Jerusalem, will be affected by this cup of staggering that is Jerusalem. So despite the implication of Zechariah, it might only be nations nearby to Jerusalem. Jeremiah much more specifically calls out certain nations within the Middle Eastern geography, but then expands that to a global, a universal scale. And inherent in this thought is that the nations involved are those that are threatening Jerusalem and Judah. Bringing that into modern times, it is speaking of Israel as it exists today, or as it might exist in the near future. And especially Jerusalem as Israel's capital. So it is likely that there might be some few nations that are not a threat to Israel. Perhaps they will not be affected. That said, you know, like any broad-based war, even nations that aren't directly involved are affected in many ways. And as connected as the world is today, it is hard to imagine any nation being an exception to the rule, no matter if they're a friend to Israel. Because if you are a friend to Israel, then you too are going to be a target for the world's fury for supporting the enemy of the world. It's hard to dash any hopes of finding a nation to escape to when all hell breaks loose. Now, the final part of the verse makes it clear that the city of Jerusalem is not the only target of the nations. It includes all of Judah, modern Israel. It speaks in terms of a siege against it. Now, I think we need to take the word siege in a broader sense than what the word means technically or historically. Technically, it means that an army surrounds the city, lets no one in or out, and eventually food and water run out and the city has to surrender. Here, considering the modern age, it more likely means being under attack from all sides. Verse 3 continues with further describing the scenario. And that passage begins with, on that day. Some translate it as in that day. Still others, when that day comes. Doesn't matter. These are all synonyms of the end times day of judgment, also known as the day of the Lord. Some Bible teachers and scholars try to find a way to differentiate one from the other, but such precision is unnecessary. Sometimes it's just a matter of using a phrase that works in the best meter, or it sounds best when spoken, depending on the circumstance. They all point to the same thing. These terms occur again and again in the prophets. They always wind up describing the future when God visits his wrath on the nations and he rescues Israel from them. Now, this verse continues that Jerusalem will become a burden stone to these attacking nations. The term is most unusual, especially when it is used of Jerusalem, and in Hebrew is Eben Amasa. Literally, it means a stone of burden, and it is common among Bible teachers to say that this is referring to the Greek sport of weightlifting, usually stones. That's very far-fetched. Okay, if any guess at least stays within the realm of the scriptures and Hebrew, not Greek, thought and culture, it probably has to do with a number of references in the Tanakh to Israel, to Jerusalem, and to the tribes, etc., as being represented as some type of a stone, like a precious stone. But here, because these are heathen Gentiles attacking Jerusalem, Jerusalem for them is a burden stone, a negative thing. It's going to cause them exhaustion and harm. It will be like trying to unsuccessfully lift a hard, jagged, heavy rock that causes them nothing but bruises and cuts. Now notice how at the end of verse 3, Zechariah also expands the scope of who will be attacking Jerusalem to more mirror Jeremiah. It says, and all the nations of the earth will be amassed against her. So I think we can remove any doubt that when this attack comes against Israel, the armies will represent every single nation on earth. All nations will be aligned against Israel and thereby opposed to God. No single nation, not even a superpower, could hope to win in such a situation. I want to offer what is admittedly speculation. Israel is simply too small for every nation on earth to send large mechanized armies. There wouldn't even be room for them to assemble. So I suspect that what we'll see is that nearby nations will use their armies, backed by the weaponry, intelligence, technology, and supplies of other and larger nations acting as allies. Now, perhaps nations with air superiority and aircraft carriers to launch planes from would participate in that way. That might explain this strange tension between Zechariah first talking about nearby armies doing the attacking, and then a few words later about the nations of the whole world involving themselves. And as hard as it might be for us to accept, the world's nations will on this occasion join forces to fight one enemy, Israel. What that final catalyst will be that sets this off, I don't know. But as Zechariah 12 shows us, what they don't know is that their military superiority matters not at all. They are fighting God. That fight's not winnable because God doesn't play fair, nor does he go by the Geneva Convention. Now, verse 4 again begins with these words speaking of the end times, on that day. This term appears 7 times in chapter 12 to emphasize the future nature of it. So it is pointless for anyone to be looking to the past or even to Zechariah's present to see if somehow this prophecy fits. Yehovah says, I will smite. Now, the key word here is I. Far from God only empowering the army of his people to fight, which he also does, he will directly intervene on Israel's behalf, just as he did when fighting for Israel when they were under such oppression in Egypt. Now, the word that we translate as smite in Hebrew is nakah. It's far more than striking or hitting. It inherently includes the idea of defeating whoever it is that's being struck. Now, one way to do that is for God to inflict diseases upon the enemy that weakens, incapacitates, even kills them quickly and in vast numbers. This passage says that God will smite the enemy's horses with bewilderment or astonishment, and their riders with madness, insanity. Now, usually such words are figurative in the Bible. For instance, when in 2 Kings chapter 6, Elisha prayed and God responded, it says that he smote the enemy with blindness. But the blindness wasn't so much a loss of eyesight as it was a mental blindness that did not allow them to properly assess the situation around them, so they were confused and rather easily defeated. Thus, here in verse 4, no doubt, the use of horses and riders that become panicked and befuddled is symbolic of whatever war equipment is used in the future when this prophecy comes about, and it also has to do with the people operating the machinery. Now, I'm not going to venture to guess about it, but you get the picture. The equipment becomes inoperative, and the equipment operators panic when they can't make it operate like it's supposed to. Clearly, because virtually all the equipment behaves in the same way, the soldiers will be terrified at what this might mean, and they probably quit fighting and run for their lives. However, says Yehovah, as opposed to what he will do to the nations, he will keep watch over Judah, over Israel. That means he'll safeguard them. The Hebrew more literally says, I will open my eyes over Judah. And no doubt using this choice of words is meant to contrast with the blindness, a closing of eyes, that God inflicts upon the nations. The nations being God's enemies. So God is acutely aware closely guarding Israel at the same time he is in process of defeating the armies of the world. Now, the Bible shows us that unless God decides to use a nation to punish his people, as he did with Assyria and Babylon, then the reality is that nations that try to harm Israel always wind up on the losing end of the deal, no matter how improbable. Why is that? Let's go back to Genesis, chapter 12, starting at verse 1. Now Adonai said to Avram, get yourself up out of your country, away from your kinsmen, away from your father's house, and go to the land that I'll show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you are to be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you. But I'll curse anyone who curses you. And by you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. You know, as much as it riles the bulk of the Constantinian church, the reality is that yes, God does have a special love and concern reserved just for his covenant people above his love for others. I have had many mainstream Christians challenge me on that because they believe that they have replaced Israel as God's cherished people. And so now they are the most beloved of God. They are a New Testament church, you see, because everything in the Old Testament's now outdated and superseded, and anywhere we find blessing and protection and love for Judah and Israel, just scratch it out. Replace it with church. See, it seems to do little good to tell them that God will always show special allegiance and favor to Israel, even pointing it out in the Bible, because it just seems unfathomable to their closed and made-up minds. Recent history doesn't matter either. I mean, the kind of blindness of the church is similar to the kind of blindness and madness that is going to strike the nations and their leaders. See, the church's blindness affects them spiritually. The nation's blindness affects them militarily. It causes them to refuse to accept what's clearly before them. So they decide, they react irrationally. And this leads to their demise. So much like his dealing with Pharaoh, this is God using the darkest side of our human nature against them. This is unpleasant to speak about, to think about. But it's true. And we must not kick against the goad because we don't like it, or we think it unfair in our eyes. Now, verse 5 speaks not only about the leaders, but rather the clans of Judah. This is meaning social units, as opposed to only those in leadership roles. So it is those who form the various clans who come to fight for the sake of Jerusalem. And they can feel most confident that despite the impossible odds, they will win, because Yahweh has empowered their military officers. And these clans will say to themselves, they will sincerely believe that Jerusalem will not be taken. Now, the thing to understand is that even though archaic terms are being used, what this is saying is that the population of Israel will be united in their conviction. And their conviction is based on their belief that the inhabitants of Jerusalem are mighty due to God having chosen Jerusalem as his holy city. So at the same time, the enemy will be stricken with panic as their war machinery fails them, so will the inhabitants of Jerusalem grow in confidence and recognition that their God's fighting for them. And even this newfound strength is because Yahweh of hosts has put within them the faith to believe. Then in verse 6, the results of this fierce faith are described. Yet again, on that day, or by using another of the several synonymous terms for it, which means the end times battle for Jerusalem, the clans will be like basins of fire put under stacks of wood, or a torch put under a bundle of dry grain stalks. For some reason, a number of translators switch from saying clans to saying leaders. Even in both cases, it uses the same Hebrew word, aluf. It's too ambiguous to say with certainty which is correct, but to me it reads better to say the word clans, unless it's only the leaders of the clans who will be likened to a fire that destroys, and the enemy nations as to that which gets burned up. See, fire in the Bible is usually said to do one of two things: destroy or purify. So a destructive fire consumes, while a purifying fire recreates and elevates. Israel is also going to go through fire in this end times war. However, God will not consume them. He will purify them. Now, I want to momentarily allude to the fact that the pile of wood and the stack of sheaves are meant symbolically to represent the political and military threat to Jerusalem and all of Israel. And by definition, then, the wood and the sheaves are all the enemies of God. We should not forget to factor in the end times harvest metaphor that Christ was pleased to regularly use. That is but another means of explaining what we are reading here in Zechariah 5 and 6 about what happens to God's enemies at the end of the age. Now, Matthew 13, 34 through 40, says this: "All these things Yeshua said to the crowds in parables. Indeed, he said nothing to them without using a parable. This was to fulfill what had been spoken through the prophet: I'll open my mouth in parables. I will say what has been hidden since the creation of the universe." Then he left the crowds and he went into the house, and his Talmidim, his disciples, approached him and said, "Explain to us the parable of the weeds in the field." And he answered, "The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world. As for the good seed, these are the people who belong to the kingdom. The weeds are the people who belong to the evil one. The enemy who sows them is the adversary. The harvest is the end of the age. The harvesters are angels. Just as the weeds are collected and burned up in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age." So the last half of 6, verse 6, takes us back to the issue of at one time speaking of the surrounding nations, then another time speaking of all the nations of the earth. Verse 6 says, this complete destruction is about the surrounding nations. And again, are we to assume that there is a distinction being made between the closer by nations versus all the rest of the nations of the world? Or should we see them both together as a unit, and what happens to some happens to all? Well, I can't accept that this is meant to be mysterious or misleading. Nor should we simplistically view the fate of both near and far away nations together, especially when we read Jeremiah that speaks of the same thing, but in a much more expansive way, and we find listed the surrounding Middle Eastern nations that have become the perennial enemies of Israel, except for occasional historically brief bursts of friendship. I feel pretty confident that the firm message here is that the surrounding nations geographically located near to Jerusalem are going to be obliterated. Generally speaking, few to no survivors. These are those that have been enemies of Israel for millennia, as highlighted by Jeremiah, and today more than ever. Now, if we go by the more historically recent reason for the acute animosity, which reason has only grown in our time, with the intractable hatred, never-ending hostilities, then the cause is clearly Islam. I mean, on the one hand, Islam is both a political and religious system and identity. Unlike the parts of the world that can be said to be Judeo-Christian, whereby the government is not ruled by the religion and vice versa, Islam is. This is especially so for the nations nearer to Jerusalem. Therefore, it might be that the immutable desire of Islam to erase Israel and all Jews from our planet and their primary national locations that surround Jerusalem, that's what's at play here. But then again, something else could come along that isn't really apparent just yet. At the same time, it means that all the other nations of the earth, while being gravely damaged, will survive. In fact, we read in various prophets about following the end times war and then Yeshua reigning from the new temple in Jerusalem that nations will send leaders and representatives to Jerusalem. So obviously, the earth will continue throughout that thousand-year period of Messiah's earthly reign to be divided into nations. Good information for us to know. Now, the statement about these nearby nations more or less concludes with characterizing them as existing on the right and the left of Jerusalem. This term is called merism. That means it operates like bookends. It explains one end and then the other and then everything in between. So it's expressing that there will not be any exceptions. It's inclusive of all the nearby nations. The verse ends by drawing a comparison to what will happen to Jerusalem. But those last few words aren't as they might seem to us. You know, a much more literal rendering of the last phrase in verse 6 is, "And Jerusalem hath inhabited again her place in Jerusalem." Well, what's happening here is this. In the Hebrew mind, from a biblical perspective, Jerusalem is here being personified as a female, as a woman. Israel and Jerusalem are regularly personified in the Tanakh as a woman. It is a literary feature, mostly employed by Hebrew prophets and poets. One of the better examples of several that I can give to you comes from Lamentations. In Lamentations 1:1 begins, "How lonely lies the city that once thronged with people. Once great among the nations, now she is like a widow. Once princess among provinces, she has become a vassal. Bitterly she weeps at night, tears running down her cheeks. Not one of all her lovers is there to comfort her. Her friends have all betrayed her. They have become her enemies." To be clear, this passage from Lamentations is not the event Zechariah is depicting, but rather he is using a commonly employed word picture in the ancient Hebrew culture. And I have to explain it to you, but the ancient Hebrews would have seen it right away. So Jerusalem is a feminine figure here, and she has returned to her nest. The woman will be safe, secure in her home, and with her family. because all of her enemies have been permanently vanquished. In a way, the woman plays a central role in her own deliverance process, even though it is Yahweh that is divinely orchestrating it all. The bottom line is, Jerusalem will become the Jerusalem God wanted. The Hebrews, the one Hebrews have always hoped for. But the path to get there will be terrible, bloody, devastating, and long. And it will necessarily involve our entire planet. Okay, we'll pause here for today. Begin at verse 7 next time.
For more teachings of real Bible study and to rediscover God's Word with Tom Bradford, visit Torah Class today on the web, streaming TV, or download the Torah Class mobile app.